And we're back. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be speaking shortly with Rick Rosoff. Phil, you had an announcement about that. Did you see, you found that site that
yes,
you told us
yes,
about?
Yes, and it's a very simple site, Apology to Haiti, or one word, apologyto80haiti.ca. And it's got a very good history of Canada's really dirty role in the coup. Points out it was a coup. I mean, actually, I think we have laws against what they did at that meeting in Meech Lake. They got together and decided to use force and violence to remove a government of another country.
A crime was committed.
There you go.
A crime was committed. Yeah. And speaking of crimes that were committed, and we're gonna and the word coup has just come up, so I believe we're joined by Rick Rosoff of StopNATO.com. Are you there, Rick?
I am, Phil. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's becoming rather urgent. We spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, but things have happened very quickly. And every 2 days we have to learn the name of a new leader of the country. And we just were talking here about the subject of coups in history. And was this a coup, what has happened in Ukraine, in your view?
It was assuredly a coup. The fact that we had a discussion fairly recently where the prospect of such a rapid and dramatic and, in fact, violent government turnover wasn't even considered a possibility, you know, in the words coup de main in French, I think come a little bit close to it, even more than coup d'etat, that is, it's a surprise attack. Mm-hmm. And, however, it's one that, in retrospect, clearly has been long in the making and methodically planned out. But that, you know, those not in the know, like ourselves, are confronted as we were over the weekend with an instantaneous toppling of a government, the criminalization of all former government officials and the ruling party, and, you know, something roughly comparable, Phil, as we've had occasion to speak about before, to events in Germany after Hitler was installed as chancellor, when all of a sudden all political parties and the political system itself were suppressed.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly interesting that a public square full of people becomes the arbiter of what is supposed to take place in a country, and that all the Western media just fall in line with this, where if it happens in a country elsewhere that the U.S. Happens to like the government, of course, those in the square would be called terrorists or troublemakers. But certainly in this instance, we had this peculiar moment, and I want to ask you about this. On the there was a meeting of people who were holding electoral office in Ukraine. Every party within the country that was relevant to the discussion was present, and then they struck an agreement, and they said there would be early elections, there would be a shared power in the government, and it was all worked out. And witnessing it were France, Poland, and Germany witnessed, and I believe signed that, kind of signed it. And then 24 hours later, they throw it in the air like it's confetti and say, "Well, no, that's off." Could you talk about what the heck kind of process is that?
No, I mean you're exactly that determines that. You know, you're talking about the foreign ministers of what is called the Weimar Triangle, that is of France, Germany, and Poland. Yeah, that
gives me chills to hear that.
Yes, it does. Truly, it does, and it ought to. You know, we know about experiments in geometry back to the 1930s, where it was an axis at that point. It's apparently a triangle now. And this was an effort in the post-Cold War period, the post-bipolar world period, that is, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the Comecon Warsaw Pact organizations, that it was really the brainchild of, one wants to use that expression, of Zbigniew Brzezinski, the infamous former national security advisor and geostrategic architect and grand chess master.
Yes.
You know, who, being a native Pole himself, but being an avid Germanophile, the two of those should be mutually exclusive. They're not in his case. You know, pushed his concept of a Berlin-Paris-Warsaw axis to run Europe, in the post-Cold War period. And in fact, you know, something quite somewhat close to that has emerged. And the foreign ministers then of those three countries descended on Ukraine. You may recall in the digest I was sending out at the time, I said that they were coming to give the West ultimatum to Yanukovych. Mm-hmm. And indeed, that's what they did. And however, they're certainly not men of their word. And they immediately, you know, before the ink was dried on the document you alluded to, the Klitschkos and other leaders of the so-called opposition had already betrayed it. You had Klitschko, for example, going back to, you know, if the term mob rule means anything, I think it's an expression that describes what you were referring to earlier. But you know, the fact that the so-called opposition figures went back to their mob, mm-hmm. and stated in so many words, we're ashamed we had to sign such an agreement, and they spat on it essentially, and we've seen the consequence. But you know, the either eternally naive Phil or duplicitous Russian political leadership, you know, which is now once again, what's the line from the Claude Rains character Ricky in Casablanca? I'm shocked once again.
Yes.
Yet they're, you know, Western partners. This is precisely the terminology emanating from the Russian Foreign Ministry and the Kremlin. Their Western partners have let them down.
Mm-hmm.
Heavens.
Yeah.
As though the entire campaign is not a dagger aimed at the heart of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, today, Pepe Escobar, who seems to have a similar take on this to yours, he says that this is just an invitation for NATO to at least, he said they get, they're going to get the consolation prize of Western Ukraine. That seems to be what they want, and a chance to move their forces. But he says, in terms of the economy, in terms of development for that region, nobody's promising anything. They're not going to get a thing from this process.
I don't suppose. You know, when you go over so thoroughly to a foreign power and you've pledged yourself so unconditionally, why would they buy you? I mean, they've got you anyway. You have quisling fashion.
What's the asking price?
With volunteer, enthusiastic, fanatics of that sort, you don't have to buy them, and they're going to come over free. But you've seen the headlines, as we all have, that whatever is the nature of the semi-anarchic, semi-fascist order ruling in Kiev and parts of, the western part of the country right now, where they're beseeching and treating the European Union and the United States for $35 billion in bailout money. Russia had offered $15 million in loan guarantees. Russia would be foolish, to come across with a penny of that, of course.
Well, exactly. And they did say, I should have mentioned, and I'd like your comment on that, is that actually if you focus right on that meeting that night, the Russian representative who was there, he observed but did not sign the deal, and the Americans went back into that mode of, they called it, leading from behind. And they basically represented the street, didn't they?
And consistently have been. We have to recall that the infamous Victoria Nuland, about whom we spoke at some length in the last time I was on your show, Phil, had been, before the coup, maybe in Kiev seven times since the crisis erupted on November 21st, and that, cheering on the crowd, handing out pastries to them and such like, dictating, and I underline and I emphasize, repeatedly, dictating the precise terms of the post-coup government to her underling, Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. I was on a program today with a Ukrainian national, Canadian national, but ethnic Ukrainian who's now teaching in Kiev and is an advocate of the revolution, who repeated the threadbare and ludicrous, contention that all diplomats talk like this. Oh, yes. I'm sure that, somebody very high-ranking in the Russian Foreign Ministry every day talks about what the new government of Mexico is going to look like, down to the most minute particular. this sort of thing passes muster in the West. Look, a lot of us have been sick at heart and not sleeping and not eating since this occurred on Saturday. This is an event of a historical moment, mm-hmm. and it's portentous in all the wrong ways. It suggests now, for anyone who still had any illusions about what power politics are in the world arena, that the U.S. and its Western allies will resort to any methods to achieve political domination in a given country or region, ultimately globally. And whether they have to, employ people who chop off heads and eat human livers in Syria, mm-hmm. or whether they have to resort to, transparently neo-Nazis in the Ukraine to gain power, they have no reservations and they have no scruples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're speaking to Rick Rozoff, StopNATO.com. I really urge everybody to go to that site because there is a lot of anxiety in the world, and StopNATO.com is the place that you can get the kind of material you need, particularly covering what's being said by the key players. Again, I just cite Escobar's thesis today. He says it's all NATO, and of course, this is your department. You've been pointing this out. NATO is like a machine that doesn't sleep. I mean, they were always banging on somebody's door, trying to expand.
That's exactly the case. And Ukraine is we don't have to tell your listeners. Invite them to look at a map. It is geostrategically vital for a number of reasons. It is Russia's last remaining Western door to Europe and to the West as a whole. Once that door has been slammed, and it has been, Russia is effectively blockaded from Europe from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. And that's the precise intention. As this thing gets uglier, and I, for one, don't believe that the West is willing to settle with a small enclave in Western Ukraine. They want the entire country. And one of the reasons they've installed a government that they know is absolutely, unbearable to the east and the southeast of the country is precisely to provoke a confrontation so that military intervention becomes a prospect. This is basically the Balkans model played out in the Ukraine. Now, a couple of things that have to be mentioned, too, before we forget. Ukraine in the West borders the breakaway former Soviet Autonomous Republic of Transdniester with an ethnic Slavic majority, but technically was, during the Soviet period, part of the Moldovan Soviet Socialist Republic, which is primarily Romanian-speaking. Mm-hmm. And since the 2009 Twitter revolution, please look that up, listeners at home on Google, in Moldova, where the government, it was the only government headed by a political party calling itself communist in the former Soviet Union, Vladimir Voronin, was toppled with U.S. and other Western assistance and brought to bear, pan-Romanian extremists who want to turn the country back over to Romania, which say over to NATO. And now that these fanatics in the Ukraine, extremists and racists and Nazis, control the western border of Ukraine and the eastern border of Transdniester, you can expect military action to be taken against Transdniester, such as the bloody affair of the early 1990s. That's one thing you have to keep in mind. The second is, we have the so-called frozen conflicts in the Soviet Union. And officially, the four of them are Transdniester, Nagorno-Karabakh between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and Abkhazia and South Ossetia between bordering Georgia. Mm-hmm. But you also have Crimea, which is the fifth, and Crimea is the area to watch right now. Now, what we're seeing throughout Ukraine, and you've seen this yourself, Phil, is the ruling clique, however one wants to characterize them, is calling for the complete banning of opposition parties, including up until a few days ago, ruling party, Party
of
Regions.
The ruling party, the party with the most members in parliament, right?
Yeah, a million members in the country.
A million members, but also they were the largest parliamentary group, right?
Yeah, they were the plurality. Which
and
is why
and
they
these guys are saying they're banned?
What's being suggested, literally, and this word should send a shudder down people's spines, is something that's occurred in the former socialist community in Eastern Europe since the 1990s, a term that hasn't been used, I don't believe, since ancient Rome, lustration laws. Banning personnel who are members of the ruling political party or the security apparatus from any government service or government-funded mm-hmm. service forever.
Mm-hmm.
And this term has already been raised, I believe.
And how do you do that without a lot of people ending up dead and in prison?
That's ultimately
can't be done.
I
mean, it's a formula for a wreckage of the country, right? Now, I want to make sure I touch on something because you raised this issue of the cutting off of Russia, which seems to be NATO's actually what this is about for the guys at NATO headquarters. And a former Ukrainian foreign minister, Volodymyr Orzhenko, He says that the of course they need this intervention by the West, and he said otherwise you'll have a new terrifying East Asian empire that will swallow you. East Asian.
Yep.
That should be an immediate here should ring all the bells, because we've been through this thing of hating Asians. That's fundamental part of our development of Canada, the United States, and the years of talking about yellow perils. That's a yellow peril argument.
I cannot tell you how much the Russophobia has come to the fore again. I did mention I had done a radio program in the United States earlier today with a Ukrainian binational, I assume he was. And, you know, he made false, you know, knowing what my surname is, right, Rozov, made statements like Russians are civilizationally inferior and so forth. You know, things right out of the handbook of Alfred Rosenberg, another Nazi race theorist and ideologist. And this stuff, again, is permitted. And, you know, keep in mind, in Canada, I'm certain, if similar language and characterizations were employed against, other ethnic or racial or linguistic groups, they would constitute hate speech, would they not? I mean, somebody would be prosecuted for that. But you're permitted to say that about targeted people, and the degree of, keep in mind all the premises upon which the prevalent version of or interpretation of events in the Ukraine, are based have to rest on deep, virtually ineradicable Russophobia. Russians are, by their very nature, irrespective of the nature of their government or political system, evil, brutal, conniving beast. And any methods, including Nazism, are justifiable to counteract them. That is the unspoken assumption.
Yes. I've been troubled by this continual East-West discussion, the way that the media here plays it, as though saying, well, you know, they want to move to the West. The cities shine more here. The girls are prettier here. Or the music is, they all want to dance to our music. This kind of strange, delusional language. And this thing about somehow the West represents enlightenment. It's the West that produced that phenomenon in Berlin that got everybody's attention for four bloody years or six. It's there that you'll find the headquarters of all these ugly theories about Asians and Russians and anybody who's not an Aryan.
I mean, it goes back to Napoleon's phrase, scrape a Russian, you find a Tatar. In our last discussion before, you mentioned Primo Carnera, if you recall, the boxer.
Yes.
And I thought afterwards about Primo de Rivera in Spain. And that, you know, Klitschko and company are really a combination of those two. You know, some brutal boxer who ends up becoming, you know, overthrowing a parliamentary government and establishing an autocracy or, mob rule. And it's something quite like that. But again, it until people really search into their unconscious, if you will, and look at what their real, suspicions and fears and so forth are, you know, we're not going to suppress this. And this is, by the way, not suggesting, Russian people or government or history or anything are any better than anyone else. It's simply suggesting they are not the devil incarnate, which is the, inescapable conclusion one has to come from when you hear this sort of just foul and ugly propaganda coming out. What is a typical one? That Yanukovych and company's real crime was they were pro-Russian. Now, we're on the, either side of what Malcolm X once says, this is the real Mason-Dixon line, the American-Canadian border. Would you accuse your prime minister as a term of treason, of disloyalty, of being pro-American? Would that be a term of opprobrium in Canada? Yet it's natural for us in the West to believe that anyone in the Ukraine who is pro-Russian, that is, who entertains any friendly feelings towards their neighbor and kin, is a fanatic, is anti-democratic, is disloyal to his or her country, and so forth. And that's assumed. I mean, that's sort of irrational thinking. It's just taken at face value, and nobody questions it.
Yes. No, absolutely. And incidentally, we have a problem. They say this is Ukraine is on the ropes as an economy, and so they've raised this specter of, well, if we go in with the IMF, we'll find a way out of this. And something arose in this discussion that I hope you can explain it to us. Putin, on his side, said there's really no need for this to be a two-way arrangement. We could have a tripartite agreement, Russia, Ukraine and the West, and we could figure out a way to get the, you know, the economy in better shape. But he has to be excluded. Why is that the reasoning? And by the way, what does it matter with the people in the political leadership, Democratic Party, whatever, here, the NDP, the Liberals? Why don't they entertain the possibility that we could do an economic arrangement in which we would all participate? Why does Russia, why did the EU say it's only you, Ukraine, and us, the Russians are out? Why is that?
Because this is a zero-sum game. You know, to believe that the Western elites, the Western Nordic elites, you know, who have governed most of the world, sometimes you read, remember George Robertson, former Secretary General of NATO, and Patty Ashdown, you know, the Viceroy of Bosnia, almost became the Viceroy of Afghanistan, if you recollect, mm-hmm. That they jointly authored an article, I believe, in the London Times perhaps 5 or 6 years ago, bemoaning the fact that for the first time, I think they said 200 years, but we could say 500 years, half a millennium, the major Western nations are not indisputably in control of the world,
mm-hmm.
as has been the case since the era of exploration and colonization, has it not, for 500 years. This elite doesn't want to give that up. They see no reason to. They consider themselves racially, or as I was told today, civilizationally superior to everybody else.
Civilization.
I mean, that's a code word. That's an ethno-psychological code word. I'm culturally or whatever superior, meaning I am racially superior to you.
Yes.
And that Russians and other, you know, Untermenschen have an inherently authoritarian personality, right? You've heard that.
Yes. Well, the Asiatic, the whole idea of the Russian is somehow an Asian. An Asian is supposed to be automatically inferior. And yet here we are dealing with one of the great powers now, and the whole world takes its hat off and says, yeah, that's true, China, which, by the way, pretty interesting civilization, if you want to invoke that word. But they fall under this shadow.
Yeah, that Asian is considered a pejorative term, when it's, almost a majority of the human race are in Asia. Is an indication of just how out of touch, how elite, how incurably arrogant and racist the thinking is in the so-called international community, which is to say, the member states of the U.S. and NATO and the European Union, a very small percentage of the human race, less than 10%.
Yeah. By the way, we have these celebrated intellectuals who are really quite backward people. I mean, Henry Kissinger always said he didn't care about the South. He said history is East and West. And then you have this guy Brzezinski. By the way, neither one, rather, they're not representative of Middle America. They both sound like they're from somewhere else, and yet we're living in their delusions.
You put that very well. Yeah, we're living in their nightmare, their delusions of grandeur, and that the U.S. is alone in permitting foreign-born personnel who have at best mixed loyalties. I mean, this is one of the curses of a global empire, is that you have people from the conquered provinces insinuating themselves into the inner circle of power in the metropolis in order to, wreak their own vengeance or their own geopolitical design. So, in what other country, for example, and I'm the least xenophobic person in the world, I'm sure no one will misinterpret these comments, but where you have foreign-born people like Zalmay Khalilzad, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Madeleine Albright, let's go all the way down the line, not only come into positions in the federal government, ministerial positions in any other nation, but precisely in foreign policy.
Yes. Yeah, and it's always assumed he knows about Europeans. Let him run the show.
That doesn't occur in Canada. It doesn't occur in Mexico. People would be very suspicious if their foreign policy was being run by people who, it could be asserted, are concerned about homeland issues of their own.
Have a conflict of interest. A conflict of interest.
Yes, right. Don't mind using the metropolis to settle old scores in their homeland, which is, in many instances is occurring.
Yeah. No, it is a shocking situation. This is Rick Rozov, StopNATO.com. And lastly, Rick, I got to ask you, as I say, every third day we have a new leader. What do you anticipate and would you expect? Everybody, of course, wonders if there's going to be a civil war, et cetera. What do you think? What's your best guess?
Heaven knows, this is one I wouldn't even touch, in terms of predicting. But I can tell you.
You're as smart as we tell people.
You know, if people had simply, if the subversives had simply left this situation alone, there would have been a, you know, election next February within a year. That, you know, in any other country, they would have been told to wait for that, no? Mm-hmm. And, you know, done their work. Then, you know, the agreement you talked about, which was abrogated as soon as it was arranged, you know, moved up that election to next December. Now it's next May. May, rather. And so what you're going to have is a scrambling of, you know, every possible, you know, form of opposition, all of whom are going to garner a good deal of money domestically and internationally, and maybe running for no other reason in certain instances. But what you're going to see inevitably is a runoff election and a coalition government. But the coalition government is going to have a very heavy representation, not only of you know, the right-wing political parties, but particularly, I think, of the right sector, the Pravi sector, which is, you know, contains fascist neo-Nazis.
That will be the
Bandera.
That will be very interesting. I hate to say, interesting in a scary sense. Well, it turns out
There's something to be.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Maybe there's something to be said about tearing the mask off what's been occurring for the last 25 years. Look, you know, Nazis and Nazi accommodationists and apologists and collaborationists have come to power in Croatia and Latvia and Estonia, and the whole world has chosen to ignore it. Now, I don't believe they're going to be able to ignore this any longer with what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, and that'll give us some choices here, the time to that people wake up. Rick Razov, thank you very, very much. Very enlightening, and it turned out you could answer that question. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. Rick Razov, StopNATO.com. I urge you to go to that site. And you're listening to the Taylor Report. You can write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM, and you can check us out, Taylor-Report.com. And Phil Connon is here. We have a couple of minutes. Phil, Rick is always on the money, ain't he?
He is. A Classical Underground tomorrow, I'm going to play some Russian music because I just want to remind people that there's a culture and a civilization there. They're not a bunch of savages or Untermenschen, as they were called by the Germans.
One of those guys wrote a book called War and Peace.
War and Peace. You know? And I'm going to play
this. He knew how to write and everything.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you pointed out earlier on an earlier program that some people are talking about fantasizing returning to the 19th century. And I think you want to remind people that in the 19th century, Russia...
they did rather well.
Yeah, they did well. They got to Paris, right?
They did. And they gave us they changed some of the language.
Right. You know, and in the 20th century, they got to Berlin.
Bistro. Bistro is a Russian word. And the Parisians learned it the hard way. Yeah. Any rate, you're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and... I think we just about done it. Write to us, Taylor@CIUT.FM. We'll see you next week.